Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and we are into the teens, number 19, episode number 82. We have aged significantly since we began, but here we are in the final 19 episodes of this series. Tonight, we're talking about No Country for Old Men from 2007. And Pulp Fiction from 1994, two movies that I'm assuming pretty much everybody watching this has seen. I'd be floored if you haven't. Pulp Fiction was pretty much must viewing for anybody who was ever born and said that they liked movies. No Country for Old Men, being that it was the only Coen Brothers film to win Best Picture, has kind of led to its legacy and the fact that it beat There Will Be Blood and Atonement and Juno. Michael Clayton was the fifth movie nominated that year, but also a year that had Gone Baby Gone and all these just phenomenal movies. Really adds to its legacy. But John, you have No Country on your list. I don't. We both had Pulp Fiction. I just had it rightfully much higher than you. When was the last time you sat down and watched either of these movies?
No Country, I watched last summer, I think. I was at home with my parents, and half the people that were in the house had never seen the movie before for some reason. I was like, okay, we're watching this movie. Pulp Fiction, it's probably been like 3, 4, maybe even 5 years since I last watched it. So it's been a while, but these are movies that have just this lasting legacy that you sit down, you watch, and you remember why you love them so much.
Yeah, you really do. So last time I watched No Country was actually on a plane because it was, you know, one of those like transnational, what is the name of that flight from coast to coast, whatever the hell it is. But anyway, I was going from New Jersey to LA, and I watched No Country on a plane, which obviously doesn't get the scope of it, but I've seen the movie 100 times. I could pretty much quote everything Tommy Lee Jones says in the entire movie. Could pretty much quote Javier Bardem too, because he doesn't talk. But so No Country and Pulp Fiction, I think, might be two of the most taken for granted movies in the history in the last 20 years, let's put it, or the last 30 years, because now Pulp Fiction's 28 years old. Pulp Fiction's getting as close to as old as us. You'll never catch us, though. But I think they're just taken for granted because the Coen brothers are obviously so impressive, and they've had so many movies with even since this one. I mean, True Grit came out just 3 years later. Obviously, they have The Big Lebowski, which everybody loves. They have, you know, they have Fargo and Raising Arizona and Miller's Crossing and Inside Llewyn Davis and A Serious Man. It's kind of like, what is your favorite Coen brothers movie? Everybody pretty much has a different answer because they are so unique, and all of their movies are unique. I mean, I have Inside Llewyn Davis, I think, as my number two behind Fargo. I'd have to go back and actually see. Where do I have Fargo? I have Fargo just ahead of Inside Llewyn Davis. So Fargo's my number one, but I have Inside Llewyn Davis at number two. You have Fargo, I believe, as your number one. You have No Country as your number two. That doesn't mean, though, that Fargo is a guaranteed number one because there's so many other movies. But what's funny on the opposite end with a movie like Pulp Fiction is every time Quentin Tarantino puts out a new movie, people say, wow, that one's just as good as Pulp Fiction. That one might be better than Pulp Fiction. That one is better than Pulp Fiction. And after rewatching it this time, I probably didn't watch it in like 10 years. The reason we keep saying that is because Pulp Fiction is untouchable. It is literally untouchable. And I know you have Reservoir Dogs higher, and like that is, you know, and I think you might even have
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood higher too.
And I get it. I do get it. Reservoir Dogs, I feel, is a little overrated, but we'll watch that. I haven't seen that in like 15 years, so maybe I'll like it more now. But I always did find it to be kind of like one note, whereas Pulp Fiction, I feel like, just is so broad. But we take Pulp Fiction for granted. We just take it for granted, and we take No Country for Old Men for granted. And you know, I think that's like the big takeaway from this. But we should start with No Country, so you can rebut and you can talk all about why you have No Country in your top 19.
Well, I mean, what it really comes down to with No Country for Old Men, and there are things to consider with this. 2007 is just like one of the best years in cinematic history. You already talked about the five pictures that were nominated for Best Picture. I have one of those movies that lost to this movie as number two on my list. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've watched more of these movies that weren't nominated. Things like Gone Baby Gone. Things like
Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Into the Wild, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward, whatever the full title of that movie is.
Yeah, like, exactly.
There are just so many good movies in 2007. And 2007 marks this really weird year where American filmmakers kind of just decided, hey, we like Westerns again.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this beautiful neo-Western, like, based off the novel by Cormac McCarthy, who I think is a phenomenal American author. And we have the Coen brothers doing something that they don't normally do. And that's the big thing with this movie, is it really shows the depth of the Coen brothers bring. Because the Coen brothers, when you think of all these movies that you've already listed off for the Coen brothers, we're talking about like witty dialogues, kind of like a Tarantino-esque, like witty dialogues and things like that. No Country for Old Men isn't that. In fact, the Coen brothers pared down the amount of dialogue in this movie compared to the book.
Yeah.
And it fits this movie so well, because what we have is we have the establishment of one of the greatest film villains of all time.
Yeah.
We have this haunting theme of the world passing us by and like evolving past us that radiates through both of these, like the opening and closing soliloquies of Tommy Lee Jones's characters, and it's set to this beautiful, gorgeous film that just leaves you in awe every time something happens, because you never expect what's happening is going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest thing with this movie. I think this movie just remains so shocking throughout. And like you were talking about with the massiveness of this, I mean, this was Roger Deakins was nominated for this and The Assassination of Jesse James in the same year. And he had never won an Oscar up to that point, but he could not beat Robert Elswit, who really hasn't done much that's all that impressive. I mean, Nightcrawler is a great looking movie, don't get me wrong. And something like Punch Drunk Love is interesting, but he's never hit that level of what he did with There Will Be Blood. And he probably never will again. I mean, that's one of the most beautifully shot movies ever made. So Deakins loses for this, but I think what's so impressive about this movie is, especially looking back at like just West Texas in general, right? Like people don't generally go to West Texas. If you do, you fly into El Paso and you go to El Paso, but you don't really go to anything in between San Antonio and Dallas and all the way out there in El Paso. There's nothing there. It's the middle of nowhere. That's where you get all the good quarterbacks in the NFL and Wichita Falls and all that stuff, because that's where like Odessa's what Friday Night Lights is based on, because there's nothing else there. And I think the Coens capture that so well in this movie, the enormity of West Texas and just how disturbing it can be out there, because there's just nothing there. You know, we'll talk about that with Wild Tales, which I actually have one of my next movies, but there's one segment of Wild Tales that takes place on a deserted road in Argentina. And it's terrifying, because you start to realize with some of this, if you when you're in these situations, I talked about nocturnal animals. There's nothing in West Texas. So if something goes wrong, if you run into a psychopath like Javier Bardem, there's nothing you can do to stop yourself unless you're driving on a major highway, which even if you're driving on a major highway, you might see 10 cars the entire day if you drive for 8 hours. I've done that drive from El Paso to Odessa. There is nothing there. And so I just think it's really interesting how the Coens were able to capture that with this good-hearted Tommy Lee Jones character who's just like, you know, the older one, and it meant something to be a sheriff and this, that, whatever. And it leads to the arrest of this Mexican man. That's all we know. He's a Mexican man with a weird haircut. That's it. And then he murders somebody and we just see him go on his thing after that, that Tommy Lee Jones start. And it's so funny because throughout this movie, Tommy Lee Jones was nominated for this. Tommy Lee Jones doesn't come into the movie until 30 minutes into the movie. If you try to put that in a screenplay as your first screenplay, they'll tell you, oh, this will never work. You're right. It'll just win you best fucking picture. Anyway, so Tommy Lee Jones's character though the whole time is a step behind. And all the conversations he's having with people are once people stop saying sir and ma'am, it all goes down from there and whatever. And we're seeing the extreme of Anton Chigurh, who is just so emotionless and has to play a game with it. He won't make the call, or Kelly McDonald won't make the call because you're going to kill me anyway. I don't care. But he needs that. He feeds off of that. Those polar opposites competing. And then right in the middle, you have Josh Brolin, who the whole movie is good and bad. And you know Tommy Lee Jones is like purely good. And you know Anton Chigurh is purely bad. Josh Brolin is smack in the middle. And for the Coens to be able to balance it the way they did and put it in this desolate setting, it's brilliant. And it's a briefcase movie, just like Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess I hadn't really even made that connection. But yeah, it's a briefcase movie. It's the pursuit of what's in this briefcase. And this spectrum of characters that we get of, like you said, like we kind of have the altruistic Tommy Lee Jones character, the completely villainous and off his rails Anton Chigurh, and then you have Llewellyn in the middle, who you know he's doing bad things because he's stealing this $2 million, but at the same time you're still rooting for him because he's not as evil as Anton Chigurh.
Well, and the really smart move is, who's he stealing the $2 million from?
Yes. Drug lords.
So who cares that he's stealing $2 million? Here's a guy who's living in a trailer. He's, you know, he has a wife. He's, you know, he seems like a good enough guy. Why not? Why can't he steal the $2 million? Like, would you not want to take that $2 million? I'd take that $2 million. Forget it. I take it for sure.
Yeah. Like, I mean, $2 million definitely goes a long way in 1980 West Texas.
Absolutely. How could you say no when you look at what his life is? How could you ever say no to that amount of money? You can't.
Yeah. And
you're not feeling for anybody who's going to miss it, and they're all dead.
Yeah. And the other thing that makes it so easy to root for Llewellyn is you see how intuitive he is this entire film. Mm-hmm. Every single moment is so precisely executed in his actions. You have even like the very beginning when we get to the shootout and he asked the one guy about the last man standing, and then he goes to the logical place where he would go, the only source of shade in the area, and he sits there and he waits to make sure he is not moving before going in. Like, it's those little tiny details that if you're not paying close enough attention or someone doesn't point them out to you, you're going to miss them. It's the curtain being slightly ajar in the hotel room. Like, it's those little details that the Coen brothers put so much emphasis on that really goes to show how this character is thinking at every single move.
Well, and it's important because Anton Chigurh is untouchable, right? We see it from Woody Harrelson's character. I can never remember the name of, but we see it from Woody Harrelson's character, who's barely in the movie. He gets called in to take care of Chigurh, and he can't do it. When he goes and he sees Llewellyn, he says to him, wow, you saw him and you're still alive. That's impressive. But you don't understand what you're up against. But Llewellyn really is a match for Anton Chigurh in a way that other people aren't, the way that he's really never been challenged before. And a lot of that is he's a hunter. He was served in Vietnam. He did all that stuff. Like, we get those important details that would make it make sense that he can track, that he is paying attention to the details. And I think another really important key in this movie is when he does decide to go back and give the water because he's just too good of a person that he can't sleep. He's not somebody who's trying to steal his meal ticket, right? He just happened to stumble across it. And why shouldn't he stumble across it and keep it? You know, he deserves it in his mind, but he's not bad enough of a person that when somebody's dying, he says to himself, God, I got to go back and check, like, for his own conscience. And we see that a couple times throughout the movie where his conscience weighs on him and it gets him into trouble. And we do see the Mexicans come after him there. Now, what's funny about the Mexicans in that part, though, is they come after him. And then you start to think, oh, okay, well, they're only able to track him because of that. Then you find out that there's the receiver in there, but you also know that that's what Javier Bardem is using to find him. So it's still, how are the Mexicans tracking him? And then you find, oh, they gave them a second receiver. That's why. Once Woody Harrelson comes into it and whatever, that's why. But I think it's really important because what it feels like in that moment is, oh, they're only catching him because he slipped up. They would have caught him eventually, but now he's more on his toes because he knows that they know that he's there. Now he is more alert as opposed to just taking the money, going home. They show up at his trailer and they try to kill him.
Yeah. I mean, him going back for the water pretty much prolongs his life because he knows how to react at that point, because he knows at that point they're able to track him because of his truck being there. Mm-hmm. They know they're going to be able to find him. It doesn't matter that there's a tracker there. And it sets off the entire rest of the film because this is where we see survivalist Lou Ellen do his thing. This is where we see him go full out. He understands what's happening and he just goes for it. And it's such a compelling story to follow that and see him do this entire time. And it's those little interactions too, right? Like something like, I need tent poles. Okay, well, tell me your model number and I'll order them. Well, never mind. I need a tent. And what type do you need? The one with the most poles. Like, it's these little things where he's just so he's such an intelligent character. And you just really want to see him succeed because of how he's thinking about these situations.
And the only reason he fails is because he lets his guard down. If he doesn't let his guard down, he survives. But he lets his guard down when he sees the girl at the pool and she says, come on in and have beer. Now, I know what beers lead to. I'm waiting for my wife, whatever. And he lets his guard down and he gets killed because of it. And what I think is the best decision in this movie is that Chigurh doesn't kill him. It's the others who kill him. Like, Chigurh could not keep up with him, but he is so focused on Anton Chigurh that he completely forgets that there's something else that could come and kill him. And he gets killed by the Mexicans. I mean, I keep saying that, but that's what they call it in the movie. It's just, they're the Mexicans. They don't have, there's no named character. There's nothing. And I actually think that works for the movie too, because you have three really strong characters who actually don't impact each other's lives really all that much. Tommy Lee Jones never catches up to Anton Chigurh or to Llewellyn. And Anton Chigurh only catches up to Llewellyn one time. They have their big shootout and then he never finds him again.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's great, because when we see these characters and they're still interacting with each other, but they're not conversing with each other, it puts them into this different frame of mind. And it's a different way of presenting characters that we're not used to in cinema. We're used to seeing characters who regularly interact with each other and their paths cross. And in this case, we see characters who are constantly chasing each other or trying to find each other, figure out what's going on, but have never get the opportunity to actually have a conversation. Even like Chigurh and Llewellyn, when they do finally confront each other, they say like 10 words to each other.
Yeah, they really do. They almost say nothing to each other because Chigurh's not a talker, right? Chigurh does the what's the most you ever lost on a coin toss, and he's intimidating and all that, but he's not somebody who says, I'm going to kill you and then I'm going to shoot you and then I'm going to do this. He's just trying to kill him. And I love the part where he blows the doorknob thing out right into his shoulder, because that just sets the tone for what that scene is going to be, which is, okay, now it's cat and mouse. You're on the run. Goodbye. See you later. There's no conversation. There's no, let me try to negotiate. It's over. And the only time he really does try to negotiate is when Carson Wells walks in, but that's because he wants the information about to go kill Stephen Root. That's all he wants. Yeah. He just wants the info to go kill Stephen Root, because now he knows that's where he was hired. And it's like an FU to Carson Wells, who thought that he was going to come in and take care of him.
Yeah. And there's two scenes that I really want to talk about right there, is that the hotel when Sugar like blows out the lock into his chest, I really want to talk about the few moments that happened before that, where we're starting to really see the ingenious of these two characters interact with each other, because Llewellyn can tell there's someone outside the door, and to double check, he turns the lights off so he can see the shadow coming under the door. But Sugar picks up on that and undoes the light bulb in the hallway so that there's no shadow anymore, so he can't tell if he's there or not. And like, this is the genius of these two characters and the way they interact, and the little details that the Coen brothers put into this movie to show that ingenuity. And then when we get to the scene with Woody Harrelson there, there's a moment where the phone rings, and you can see in Woody Harrelson's face, he knows he's about to die. Carson Wells just knows at that exact moment he is done for. And it's so beautifully acted. It is fantastic. The little nuances in Anton Chigurh's characters, like him taking his boots off so that they don't get blood on them, it's just all brilliant.
It is. It is. And like, those scenes are really good. I mean, obviously, like, the most memorable one. Are you still seeing the porn ad over on the side there? I can't get rid of it. It literally, YouTube is terrible, I guess. So I'll just start doing go away. I tried to even open up a new one, but unless I refresh it, it won't do it. So I'm just going to put a bunch of random letters in here until eventually it completely goes away, because I blocked the first one and then the second one, it won't let me block. So blame YouTube. Don't blame us. It literally won't let me block it or put it in timeout. I keep saying error occurred. I don't know why. I didn't make an error. Okay, there you go. So I agree with you. Obviously, so Anton Chigurh's character in this is the most memorable scene is the scene for him is the scene in the random stop at the gas station. Yeah. Like that is the all time scene with the call it and, you know, what's the most you ever lost on a coin toss. And he's talking about you live back there and all this stuff. It really just shows what a sick person he is, because he doesn't care. He's not out for this guy. He's not trying to kill this guy, but he will kill him if that's what the coin wants. This coin has traveled all the way here. Don't just put it in your pocket. It'll get lost with all the other quarters. That's your quarter. That's your lucky quarter. Like, it's been traveling all this time to get here, just like I have, just like everybody who crosses paths with him has. And it kind of shows like this philosophical side to him, even if the philosophy is completely deranged. But I think what's fun about that is we see that scene. And then when we start to see those later scenes of him outsmarting Llewellyn while Llewellyn is outsmarting him, it makes sense, because it shows that this guy is a thinker. He's not the Terminator. He's not just walking through shooting people. He's not Michael Myers. He has that same approach where he just walks after you and he just wants to take care of business. But he is so much deeper of a thinker. And that is what is so important, I think.
There was a study in either 2017 or 2018 where 400 psychologists sat down and identified 196 psychopaths out of films. And the number one consensus for the best depiction of a psychopath is Anton Chigurh.
I believe it.
And it is because of that disassociation, right? He doesn't associate with society at all. He's in his own world. And that's what makes him so good of a villain in this movie. This movie that's talking about the world moving past people, Anton Chigurh is outside of that world because it's not affecting him at all.
Yeah. I'm looking up this thing right here. That's really interesting. All right. Anyway. He doesn't care. He doesn't care where he fits into society. He just does what he has to do. He kills the people who are willing to pay him. He kills whoever he has to kill, whoever gets in his way. He goes and kills Stephen because he gave the Mexicans a tracker and that pissed them off. He didn't want that. So he goes and kills them. That's the only reason. And I love, for some reason, I always find the line of "look at that fucking bone" to be one of the funniest lines in film history, because that kid just staring at it and like whatever. But I even love the ending when Chigurh is like, okay, how am I going to get away now? Because the police are coming. I need to find a way to get away from this. And what is it that ultimately stops him from this pursuit? It's somebody random, just like what stopped Llewellyn, and just like what has pretty much set Tommy Lee Jones on the path that he's on. I think that's what's interesting about a movie like No Country for Old Men. There's so much randomness to it. And that's okay, because it's really just expressing the randomness that kind of brings you throughout life. That coin, right? It's such a random thing, but it did travel to get to you somehow, some way. Like, you know, he's thinking about the serendipity scene where he writes the number on the dollar bill, but this is not all that much different. We just don't think of, you don't put anything serious into that, right? But you go to a restaurant and you get food poisoning that night. You're like, oh my God, like I got food poisoning. But do you really think about, I chose to go there. I had to eat there at that exact time and order that exact food on that exact night. Like all of those things are so interesting. And I feel like No Country brings those questions up of what if that woman wasn't at the pool that night? What would have happened to him? What if Sugar, what if the Mexicans hadn't gotten a tracker? All of these things, like, I think it's really interesting, and I love that Sugar just gets hit by a car that's running the red light. So Sugar isn't breaking a law there. He's not doing anything wrong. He is driving through, I mean, granted he stole the car, but he's driving through a green light very calmly at the right speed. We know he kills Kelly McDonald at this point because he looks at the bottom of his shoes to see if there's any blood there. But boom, gets smashed, and it's totally random. And it's almost like all of that randomness is kind of what Sugar is based on the entire time. Everything that's random, he'll plan and he'll try to kill you and he's going to go after you and he's going to do that, but he's still going to flip a coin to determine whether or not you should be shot and killed. If you're not somebody who's necessarily in his path, like Woody Harrelson is.
Yeah. And he's just such a well-constructed character, and you have to give it to the Coen brothers, who have built that reputation of building characters off dialogue to build this intimidating character, like Javier, and like combine it with this phenomenal performance by Javier Bardem, who, I mean, this was a huge role for him, right? Huge. He was the first Spanish actor ever nominated for best actor or best supporting actor because of this film.
Mm-hmm.
Like this is a monumental moment for him as an actor. And it's really weird, because if you talk to like these casual people who watch movies and like kind of know, no one can tell you who Javier Bardem is, despite such an iconic role belonging to him.
Well, I think Skyfall kind of helped him, though, because Skyfall, you know, being James Bond, whatever. But that also came out in 2012. If you really think about it, Javier Bardem hasn't done much that's really like, I mean, he was in Dune, but was he in it for 3 or 4 seconds? Like,
yeah.
And then he was in Being the Ricardos, but nobody saw Being the Ricardos because Javier Bardem was in it. After this movie, Javier Bardem was hot. Like, not that it was like, oh, he's in everything, but he did Vicky Cristina Barcelona. He did Beautiful, which was the Alejandro Iñárritu movie. Then he did Skyfall. And then after Skyfall, he just fell off. Like, he didn't really do anything much after that. He has a couple with Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men, and Mother. But, like, it wasn't as big as it could have been. But it's funny because he was nominated for an Oscar prior to this for that movie Before Night Falls, which I never even heard of. And he didn't really start to pick up roles for that either. So despite playing such an iconic role, but I think that's the funny thing about supporting actors, right? And I'm talking pure supporting actors. Look at Christoph Waltz. Christoph Waltz does Django. He does Inglourious Basterds. Two great roles. He did that movie Water for Elephants with Robert Pattinson, which, by the way, isn't as bad as people say it is. And that was really it. That was really like Christoph Waltz isn't some household name who's in everything. He'll get bit parts in big name directors' movies. But that's really it. He's not some like larger than life character. And I think that's what's so impressive about Javier Bardem. And I think what makes this role still so powerful is that you don't go back and watch this movie and say, oh, that's Javier Bardem. You watch this movie and say, oh, that's Anton Chigurh. And oh my God, this character is disturbing as all hell.
Yeah. I mean, there are times on this podcast where we really struggle to remember the names of characters in movies, and we don't have that issue.
You don't have that with this one. No.
They're just so iconic and they're so ingrained into us. And Anton Chigurh is just one of those characters that, I mean, if people haven't seen this movie by now, which, I mean, there are some people out there, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, they just need to watch this movie to fully understand how to build an intimidating force.
It's funny because, like, when we talked about Goodfellas a couple weeks ago, I had told you that I had made my best supporting actor list, and I had Joe Pesci just at number 6. And you were like, wow. And I was like, yeah, I'm at number 6. I have Bardem at 4. And I have J.K. Simmons, Christopher Walken, and Robert De Niro ahead of Bardem. And then Joel Grey in between Bardem and Pesci. Like, the best supporting actor winners is crazy. It really, like, it is an insane award that has so many really, really deserving people. And I'm not saying the other awards don't, but we're talking iconic roles. I know you haven't seen The Deer Hunter, but Christopher Walken's performance in that is insane. De Niro playing a young Vito Corleone, like J.K. Simmons, one of the most evil villains in the last however many years, you know, regular movie. Joel Grey in Cabaret, like these roles are just crazy. And Bardem just, he is so masterful in this. And poor Tommy Lee Jones, you know, not for nothing, he shouldn't have beaten Ralph Fiennes way back during Schindler's List. That was ridiculous because Ralph Fiennes gives one of the best performances ever in that movie. But Tommy Lee Jones can't compete with Javier Bardem in this because Javier Bardem is just this is the stuff nightmares are made of. It's the stuff nightmares are made of, as well, we see with Tommy Lee Jones.
And the 2008 Oscars, the best supporting actor nominees this year were in some incredible performances.
Oh, incredible!
Like it's just a year that really it sticks out because of how strong every single category was that year.
And that's the funny thing with this. You see this all the time with like when you have a movie like There Will Be Blood, you so often see over time the movie that beat There Will Be Blood just get crapped on. We see it with Shakespeare in Love, we see it with Crash, even though Brokeback Mountain's not nearly as popular as There Will Be Blood. But we go back to The English Patient knocking off Fargo. The English Patient's a pretty good movie. Like I actually enjoy The English Patient. I enjoy Dances with Wolves. But they beat Goodfellas and Fargo, so they immediately get dropped down. Nothing happened to No Country for Old Men for beating There Will Be Blood, despite how amazing There Will Be Blood is. I think that just speaks to the strength of this year. Still, and I don't know if I have it as my highest ranked. I'd have to go back and look. But I believe my highest ranked movie from this year is Atonement. And if it's not Atonement, then it's The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
I think it's The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, but yeah.
Is it The Diving Bell and the Butterfly? And that is just... That just speaks to how good these movies this year was. And yeah, I mean, if you look at the other people that he beat out for that, he beat out Casey Affleck, Hal Holbrook. I never saw Charlie Wilson's War, but Philip Seymour Hoffman in that, and Tom Wilkinson and Michael Clayton, who's the best part of that movie by far, even though Tilda Swinton won the Oscar. But one thing before we move on, I have to talk about what is your take on this ending? Because probably one of the most controversial endings in the history of film. This ending, like, pissed people off relentlessly when they went to see this movie because it just ends and there's really no wrap up. What do you think about this ending?
I think this ending's perfect. It completely, because having, that's the whole point. This movie is supposed to just end because life goes on beyond these people. Like,
yeah,
that's the whole point of the movie. That is it perfectly encapsulates the thematic conclusion of this film. I love the ending of this film because it is just that moment where, because it just ends, you get to sit there and you kind of get to go, huh, and think about what you just watched.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really, really, really interesting. I really love this, like this ending. And I think the more I watch it, the more I love this ending because it really is just such a, and now it's over. And that's how it is. And it doesn't really bother Tommy Lee Jones all that much because he's going to retire. And instead he goes and sees his buddy who's in a wheelchair because, you know, he got shot. Did they ever catch that guy? No, like whatever. Like it just continues on. And that's the problem with being a small town detective or a sheriff or whatever is you're not going to get the same attention as when we watch Zodiac. That's all over the papers. And when something like this happens, this could be the most deranged killer there ever was, but it's 1980 and it's in West Texas and nobody cares. Nobody cares. And I think that's something really fascinating that this movie takes a look at. And, I think nails. And I think Tommy Lee Jones's weary, retiring cop is such an interesting character because of where it is and how it's treated and all that. I love it. I really do.
Yeah. It's just phenomenally built. The Coen brothers nailed it with this one. They're like I said, I like Larry Will Be Blood a lot more than this movie, but
a lot more. You have it 17 spots higher. You have both movies in your top 20. A lot more, John.
Yes, because exponentially that gap gets larger between each of these films. That's true. But yeah, like this movie, despite the fact that I like There Will Be Blood more, I'm still not upset that this is the movie that more people do end up talking about because it did win Best Picture.
Yeah. And I do think that there's something a little, even though neither movie is all that accessible, which is what's really cool. And really, Atonement's not an accessible movie either. If you really look at this, Juno was the accessible movie from that year because Michael Clayton's weird as hell. Like, I love that neither one is all that accessible, and yet they still get the notoriety that they get. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just 2007 was just a different time in American cinema.
Well, and now we have to talk about 1994, which also a pretty unbelievable year. But before that, John, best thing you watched this week, I'm going to start with mine. I'm going to say Paddington because I've already talked about it on this podcast. And again, it's the best movie I watched this week because I watched Paddington, I watched The Muppet Christmas Carol, and I watched Avatar. And it was the first time I'd watched Avatar in full since seeing it in theaters. God, that movie sucks. I hate it.
Yeah,
I hate it.
Yeah, hate it. So bad. But anyway, you watched it. We watched it in because of the Golden Globe nom saying that Avatar 2 was like a Best Picture nom. So all of a sudden, we're kind of freaking out because we have to do that. I'm glad you rewatched Avatar so that I don't have to.
There you go. I'll tell you what, John. The story is he's crippled. He goes in. There's a lot of clunky dialogue. It's really bad. And then I'm gonna be honest with you. And I understand. Yeah. It's 14 years later. It's 21 years later and Lord of the Rings still looks pretty damn good. It's almost 60 years later and Space Odyssey looks pretty damn amazing, okay?
Yeah.
Star Wars doesn't maybe look as good as it did, but it's pretty forgivable considering what it's showing. This movie looks like crap. Looks like crappy cutscenes half the time. The Na'vi things are too smooth. They look CGI. They don't look good. I don't like that movie. I don't like it. And I didn't like it when I saw it in theaters on a huge screen, and I thought maybe that was just my 17-year-old self wanting to be different from everybody else and walk around high school. But I didn't like that movie. Hate Avatar.
Yeah.
But anyway, John, what was your best?
Ooh, I watched 10 movies this week, which has been a long time since I've watched 10 movies. I want to give a shout out. I want to really give a shout out to Klaus, which I watched for the first time this movie. Year.
So
that
underrated.
Is. Probably like the best Christmas movie out there that isn't It's a Wonderful Life, which I also watched this week in theaters, and that was a fantastic experience. Other than that, I watched the rebuild of Evangelion. I had to continue my Evangelion watch because 3.0 plus 1.0 Thrice Upon a Time was playing in theaters here on Sunday. So that was the best movie I saw this week by far. Like, that movie is just incredible. Like, outside of, you know, It's a Wonderful Life, which we've already discussed in length.
Yeah, we've already talked about that on this, right? We have fake Billy Zane here saying James Cameron's best movie is Titanic. Love it. Can't get over it. Love it. Yep. It's true. Maybe it's not. But so let's jump to Pulp Fiction. Yes. Because Klaus is great. Klaus is great. It's a movie. Yep. We have a week till Christmas. If you're, you know, if you celebrate Christmas, go watch Klaus. It really did go under notice because it was on Netflix. But Pulp Fiction is, like I said, I truly believe, so this used to be in my top 10. It might go back. This movie is truly one of the most taken for granted movies in the history of film. This movie changed the game. It just changed the game. It changed what a crime thriller could be. It changed what you could do with big name actors. It revitalized Samuel Jackson and John Travolta. Might have not even revitalized Samuel Jackson. Just put Samuel Jackson on the damn map because before this, he was in Jurassic Park. He's a bit part. Like, he's not doing anything. And so I love this movie. And it's so funny to me to like see now in retrospect when people try to go back and nitpick Tarantino, he uses too many racial slurs or its dialogue is just like self-indulgent or his storylines aren't all as interesting as what we thought. It's total BS. The reason we're talking about it is because you guys want to get clicks. That's why we're talking about it. Like all these websites that have those hits on Tarantino, they're all just trying to get clicks so that they can get a conversation started. And they know that Tarantino's name is going to bring those clicks in a way that most other directors won't. But the thing with Pulp Fiction is you forget just how great the acting and the style and the stories really are. I probably, between the first time I watched this movie and my senior year of college, I probably watched this movie 30 times. And it gets to the point where you're like, okay, is it actually that good? Is it actually that good? And then you take a break from it and you come back to it and you're like, oh my God, it's crazy what he pulled off in this movie. Like, it's just unbelievable. And I had texted you about it. One of my favorite things about this movie watching at this time, because I never realized this because I watched this when I was younger. But one of my favorite things about this movie is the subversion of expectations, right? When you can step away from the movie and then come back to it. Now, obviously, samurai sword, gimp, you know, creepy Southern Confederacy guys in Los Angeles owning a gun store and raping Ving Rhames. Yeah, that's unexpected, right? Like, there's no denying that. But my favorite subtlety in this movie is the buildup of Mia Wallace, right? The buildup with Tony Rocky Horror and the foot massage and all of that. Now John Travolta finally gets with Mia Wallace and they win the dance competition. Where is this movie going? It's going to John Travolta sleeping with Mia Wallace, being on the run from his partner who he really likes, and Ving Rhames essentially hiring Bruce Willis to try to also kill him, right? That's where this movie is going. And instead she snorts heroin and it changes the whole complexion of the movie. And then there is no big whatever. That's where this movie would have finished if it was in the hands of somebody else. But Tarantino subverts that expectation. And now the problem is the adrenaline shot scene is so iconic that people don't even realize their expectations are being subverted anymore. And because we've all seen this movie so many times and like you know that that's coming. But that's the type of stuff that makes this brilliant. I really, really, really absolutely love that. And yeah, the stories are great. The acting is phenomenal. But again, like, and I'm just going to do this and I'll let you go, but I have to just throw this out there right now. Forrest Gump, Pulp Fiction, Shawshank Redemption, Ed Wood, Quiz Show, Nobody's Fool. And we don't even get into then The Lion King, Queen Margot, Bullets Over Broadway, and Three Colors Red. Mm-hmm. There's just no room. There was just no room. This won one Oscar only for screenplay. Tarantino didn't win. Samuel Jackson didn't win. But you can't really argue the other winners. I know a lot of people don't like Forrest Gump now, but Forrest Gump was almost just as groundbreaking at the time as what Pulp Fiction and Shawshank were doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because we had that conversation about like the subversion of expectation. And because you watched it earlier this week than I did, and we had that conversation first, when I rewatched it yesterday, Tarantino tells us to subvert our expectations immediately because in that opening, like very racist,
Tim Roth's not a good guy.
Nope. But in there, they're talking about the subversion of expectations of robbing a restaurant instead of a bar, a gas station, or a liquor store. And like right there, Tarantino tells us we're subverting expectations in this movie. And then he gets us three times, maybe even more throughout the movie where things just happen and we're like, wait, what's going on now? Like it goes to show the brilliance of Tarantino's script writing and the way that he builds a film. He just understands film in a way that many others do not. Like there are very few people who can understand how to properly structure a film like Tarantino does. And he does it in a non-linear way, which makes it even more impressive.
It does. And the thing with a Tarantino movie is it always has a rhythm, right? Whenever he always builds and builds, except for Death Proof, which is total garbage. But like with Inglourious Basterds, before like Shoshana, and then it builds into that like, all right, here's your cut, the Bastards or whatever. Like it's so memorable. There's such a rhythm. There's such a ba-doo-ba-doo-ba-doo. It moves along unrelenting. Yeah. And I could imagine, I always think about, I love you, Pumpkin. I love you, Honey Bunny. All right, any of you fucking pricks move, and I'll execute every last one of you right into Dick Dale and the Deltones. Boom, doom, doo, 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 doo. It's so good. And then that goes into Jungle Boogie, which goes into these two stoner hitmen just sitting around in the car talking about a Royale with cheese. It has such a pace and such a rhythm, and it's brilliant. It's so well done. And the problem is there's not much you can say about Pulp Fiction at this point because it's all been said to death. But I think that the people – like. Tarantino's fanboys are annoying. Like, don't get me wrong, but the fanboys of anybody are annoying. Like, that's just how it is. But I think that people who are now trying to sit down and say, this movie doesn't age well, all that, it's nonsense. This movie ages perfectly. Samuel Jackson is phenomenal. Yeah, there's racist dialogue, but guess what? People say racist shit in everyday conversations. I hate to break that to people. Maybe not like everyday conversations, but these types of people. You have hitmen, robbers. You have whatever mob boss, essentially, whatever Ving Rhames actually is. We don't really know. We never really get a definition of what Marcellus Wallace is. He's a gangster. Yeah. You know who Marcellus Wallace is? Does he look like a bitch? But you get all that. These are people who aren't really worried about saying the politically correct thing. That's what I'm saying. Like, these are people who in their everyday conversations, they're not worried about whose feelings they're hurting or if they're hurting anybody's feelings. They're just going to go around and they're going to kill whoever they need to kill and they're going to insult whoever they need to insult. But the dialogue that's around it is just so brilliant. I mean, you can't repeat it on a podcast, but the whole conversation after they shoot Antoine in the head with Quentin Tarantino about parking on his lawn.
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous and so cringy now, but the fact that that's where he's taking that conversation is just like, who would even think that, like, okay, this needs to be like the 2 minute conversation that we have here to show the power dynamic between all three people in this room. When John Travolta, Vincent Vega, all the names are so great. Vincent Vega, yeah. Jules Winfield, like, but when Vincent Vega is arguing with the wolf, and the wolf takes a sip of the coffee and he smiles at him and he puts it down and all that. And then it's, oh, I'm sorry. Am I not moving fast? Blah, blah, blah. All of those things. A lot of times those would be cut out of scripts, but it shows so much power. There's so much purpose to every single word that is said in this movie, every single word. And that's what's so impressive. It's building these characters, but it's also building, no. The wolf has control here. Jimmy has control here. You two are lucky that you have a freaking garage to park in. That's all you should be happy about. It's just, it's so good. It's so good. And he's so undervalued for what his dialogue is doing. Everybody wants to write Tarantino-like dialogue. They don't realize that Tarantino is always elevating the stakes every single time. I'll never forget watching the Inglourious Basterds behind the scenes. And he was doing an interview. And somebody said, how did you get the idea with the gold pipe? And he said, well, because the farmer pulled out his pipe. But Christoph Waltz did such a great amount of research on this guy that he knew he was going to smoke a pipe. So he pulled out his pipe, which was the giant gold one, because fuck you. And that was his reasoning. And that is every time that he writes anything, a character doing something, a character saying something, anything like that, it's all because of F you, I can. And he does it brilliantly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are so many power dynamics in this film that shift throughout the film. And I think that's just the brilliance of this Tarantino script is like, because we see Jules and Vincent at the very beginning. And like they're on par with each other. No one, like, you kind of get an idea that Jules has a little more say than Vincent does. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in the end, Jules isn't the person that Marcellus is going to watch his wife. Mm-hmm. He's going to Vincent. And I mean, we also had like that little tidbit of like Vincent being the brother of Michael Madsen's character from Reservoir Dogs too.
Yeah.
And like those little neat things in a Tarantino universe that he's just establishing here in his second film, but it's that shifting power dynamic, right? And then we get the like huge power discrepancy between Brett and Jules.
Yeah.
And the cut before anything happens in there to tell the rest of Vincent's story with Mia, mm-hmm. where, you know, Vincent has some power. He's like gauging his power. Then Mia has all the power. Mia has all the power in that sequence until she
overdoses. And now he needs to flip it on.
Yeah. And then it's the same with, we really see a shift in power dynamic in the Butch storyline, right? Mm-hmm. Where Butch he's just killed a man accidentally. Mm-hmm. And he was supposed to throw the fight. He's lost all of his power. And then we see him in his apartment. And again, this is another moment of that subversion of expectation where you expect the gangsters to be there. You expect them to have to deal with it. And then he gets there and the apartment's empty.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a sigh of relief. And then you see the gun.
Yep. Yep. He's making a Pop-Tart, right?
Yeah. And it's that shift of power dynamic there, right? Where Vincent should have all the power here because he is the gangster. He knows where Butch is going to come, but he's caught off guard and Butch gains all the power. And then Butch is driving away and Marcellus is there. Again, Marcellus seems to have the power. Then Butch has the power because he runs Marcellus over. But then Marcellus is the one with the gun. So Butch loses all of his power again. And that's what makes this movie so good, is it's constantly changing the way each of these characters interact with each other. And unlike No Country for Old Men, which is doing it in a way where none of the characters directly really interact with each other, this is all because of the interactions that these characters are having and the conversations they're having with each other.
And the interactions are brilliant. I mean, like, you know, the Marcellus thing seems random, but he's bringing food back to Vincent Vega. He's going back to Vincent Vega. Like, that is what is happening in that scene. And I love that, right? The power. You're talking about the power between Bruce Willis and Marcellus Wallace's characters. They think they have all the power because they're gangsters and this, that, whatever. And they go into somebody else's store.
Yeah.
Now they don't have any power and their protection isn't there and nobody's tracking them. They don't have they have cell phones in this movie, but they're gigantic. So it's all of that. And it's really interesting. And now they have no power. And then we see Bruce Willis in that moment, very much like Llewellyn in No Country for Old Men, say, I got to go back and save him. And he grabs the samurai sword off the wall, goes back and he kills the one guy. And now Marcellus Wallace has all the power. You're going to let me go? Just don't show your face in Los Angeles ever again. That's fine. And it leads to the great conversation about choppers, which I just love that. Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead is what, now a DJ? Or is that just Zed? Yep. Zed's dead is a band.
Oh, Zed's dead's a thing. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's a band. Yeah. Electronic duo. That's what it is. Canadian, too. Holy crap, I hate him. but no, I mean, I just think it's so well done. And the problem, or not the problem, but what Pulp Fiction did was it made so many copycats who couldn't figure out what it was that made Pulp Fiction work, right? Like, Go is probably the best version of this working, but we see it all the time with these wannabe gangster type flicks that are heavy on dialogue, out of order, characters bumping into each other. Why though? What's the reason? What's the purpose? They don't really have one. They're just doing it because they're trying to imitate this movie. But Tarantino is doing it in a way where, why is the Jules and Vincent scene the last one? Because it does actually show the character arc for both of those characters.
Yeah.
It is showing a completion. It's also showing a completion of what this movie is trying to say, where at the beginning it's, we got to rob, we got to kill, we got to do whatever. We don't have ethics. I might sleep with Mia Wallace. Of course I'm not going to sleep with Mia Wallace, but man, she's pretty hot. I might end up accidentally doing that, doing heroin, doing drugs, whatever. And it gets to the end where it's this conversation about, I can't do it anymore. Like, God saved me and I need to step out of this. I need to get away from this. And we see them just walk out. And that's the end of the movie. They go walking out and they let Tim Roth go and they let Honey Bunny go. And the two of them are just on their way. But there's still a character arc for everybody. There's an overall message for this movie that wouldn't be there if this movie was told in chronological order. It just wouldn't be there. But it's done in such an interesting way that people forget that there is that. They think, oh, isn't that cool? They brought back Pumpkin and Honey Bunny. Yeah, that's cool. But also now when you watch the movie at the first, you're like, oh, okay, those characters haven't come back. But now they're going to power, right? Power, power, power. They have all the power in that diner, but they don't know that Jules Winfield is sitting right there with a gun pointed right at him. They don't know. Yeah. And that is – Tarantino does that in his best movies, Inglourious Basterds, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Reservoir Dogs. The shifts in power are monumental, but they're subtle. And that is why Pulp Fiction works. And that is why nobody can top Pulp Fiction, because they want to make these interesting characters who are suave and do cool things, but they aren't. They're not making that. They're making copycats of what Tarantino did better.
Yeah, and the problem is they just don't have Tarantino dialect to go along with it either.
Yeah.
Because that is where Tarantino builds all his characters, right? I love the scene when we go back to the apartment and the guy comes out with the hand cannon and watches it. I love that Tarantino has it so you can see some of the bullet holes. Mm-hmm. And Vincent and Jules don't move for a long time. And then eventually Jules just moves and you see the three holes behind him.
Yeah.
And you just wonder, was this divine intervention? Like, how are you positing this to us? Like, how are you posing this for us? How are we supposed to believe is happening here? Did this guy just happen to miss? Or and it's beautiful because we only see him unloading. We don't see what Jules and Vincent are doing in that moment.
Yeah.
We just see him unloading this gun. And then all of a sudden, Jules moves, and there's three bullet holes behind him.
Well, and it's very interesting because we know now at this point that Vincent Vega is still alive. We know that. But we don't know if Jules Winfield is still alive. We don't know. And we see him.
We do. We do know that Jules is alive because we see him at the beginning of the Mia story when they're
in. Oh, that's right. That's correct. That's correct. But that also could have been. No, no, you're right. You're right. Because they bring the briefcase. So no, you're right. Okay. So we do know. Okay. But yeah, I still think it's very interesting. Like Jules goes away for so long. And then when he comes back, he obviously owns that last scene and everything like that. But you know, I love when he starts talking about, I thought it was just some badass ship. But now that I'm thinking about it, I'm the shepherd. I always thought I was the shepherd. Now I'm thinking about it. And I love those moments of learning, right? And using the dialogue that you used earlier that just seemed like it was trying to be flashy. And explaining why it's so important and really getting to the heart of that is great. But you're right. With the bullet holes behind him, I'd be sitting there. Did you see the size of that gun? There's no way we should still be alive, whatever. And then the funniest part about the whole thing is Vincent accidentally shoots Antoine in the head because they hit Marvin. A bumper. Marvin. I'm sorry. Yeah. Marvin. Antoine's what? Antoine Rocky
Horror. Cody Rocky Horror. Yeah.
Yeah. But he shoots Marvin in the head. Accidentally, after these guys just couldn't get killed by five or six bullets, right? It's brilliant. And I love that. Did you just hit a bump? You hit a bump or something? I didn't hit no bump. I didn't do any of that. Like, it's so funny. And here they are. We're driving in the valley. Marcellus Wallace doesn't have any friends in the valley. Like, those LA moments are so fun. I love that. I love that those guys couldn't get killed by even trying. And then Vincent Vega accidentally shoots him in the head.
Yeah, it's a brilliant moment, too. Like, the way John Travolta just says, oh, shit, I shot Marvin in the face.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so nonchalant. And then it escalates and they freak out, right? Because it has that shock moment, which is so brilliant. And, man, what a terrible, like, 48 hours for Vincent Vega.
Yeah, exactly. And but it is so much fun. With these like bad, it's all believable in a sense, right? These guys are driving around in broad daylight with the blood all over, but they go immediately. We got to go to Jimmy. That's it, Jimmy. I'm screwed. We got to do this. And I love that is called the Bonnie situation. That's the name of that segment. That is such a great name for that segment because we don't even see Bonnie from behind in her nurse's outfit, or maybe that's just how Harvey Keitel is imagining her. But that's all we see. But it's called the Bonnie situation, even though the whole thing is focusing on these two and Marvin and Jimmy and the wolf. And I mean, for all those great performances, we're going to talk about Alfred Molina very shortly with what he did in Boogie Nights. And he's only in one scene and everything. Harvey Keitel as the wolf in this movie. Oh my God. Like, it is one of the best written characters. It nails it. And if he was in five more minutes of this movie, he probably wins the Oscar. Instead, it goes to Martin Landau, who definitely deserved it for Ed Wood playing drug addicted, whatever his name is from Dracula, but Bela Lugosi. But oh my God, is Harvey Keitel amazing? This might actually, and this is a big statement, but this might actually be the best written character Tarantino's ever done. I really like it. Blows my mind every time I watch it because. I love myself, Christoph Waltz Inglourious Basterds. I love Jamie Foxx in Django. I think Brad Pitt is stellar in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But this character is just so matter of fact and so sure of himself. And that's just confident, brilliant writing. There's no question marks in anything that Harvey got. This is what you're going to do. Please would be nice. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I the one who shot him in the head? Like, it's just so it's 30 minutes away. I'll be there in 10. 9 minutes and 47 seconds later, he's whipping around the corner. I mean, at the end, when he's talking to the girl, you are a character. Or you are, what is it? You are a character. Doesn't mean you have, whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so good. Yeah. And it's this character who's barely in the movie. In this movie where there's so many other major characters. I absolutely love that character. Winston Wolf. He's my God tier Quentin Tarantino character. He really is.
Yeah, totally reasonable. And Tarantino writes him in a way. It's the little details about Winston Wolfe. It's the fact that Winston Wolfe's at a wake at the beginning when we first introduced him.
Early in the morning, too, because remember, they're going to get breakfast.
Yeah. I was like, why is there a wake at 8 o'clock in the morning? Man, guys, give it a little more time. But the fact that he drives an Acura.
Yep.
Like, and then you think about it, right? Acura has enough high performance that you can do these like fast things, but it's also nonchalant that you're not going to get pulled over driving an Acura.
Nobody's looking at you in an Acura. Everybody has an Acura.
It's like these little details that Tarantino puts into the films that really elevate it.
And I really do. After that whole conversation about coffee, I know it's good. I buy it. Because when she goes, she buys the shit. And then when he takes the sip and he turns and looks at me, he just nods and like tips the cup. That part kills me so much. Because again, with power, when Jimmy had all the power, he'll insult Jules and say, shut up. I know it's good. But now Winston has all the power and he wants to make sure his wife's not going to come home. So he doesn't say anything to that. It's so freaking – I love it. I just love it. Do you have any aunts and uncles who your aunts and uncles got you that? Your uncle Marcellus will also like to get you that. He pulls out the wad of hundreds that's bigger than my head. It's brilliant.
So earlier on, you mentioned the fact that like people say that this movie doesn't age well. I would like to argue that this is a timeless movie. And the only thing that doesn't age well is the idea of robbing people's wallets in a restaurant.
That is the only thing that doesn't age well. You're right. Otherwise,
everything
this is timeless.
Everything else completely, like, it's set, like, yes, it's very clearly the 90s for the people who understand what 90s LA is like. But other than that, this movie is so out, removed from time, right? Like, you have Jackrabbit Slims, which is beckoning back on an older time. Also, Steve Buscemi's cameo in this movie, great.
Great, great. Also, why is Jackrabbit Slims not a real place somewhere in the world?
I'm astonished that it is not.
It's amazing. Because that place looks awesome. I'd go all the
time. It does. Yeah. But you have that harkening back on like this 50s era. Even like the Butch segment is kind of harkening back on an older time of America, right? Where like boxing was a much bigger deal than it was in the 90s. And it's these little things that set it out of time, despite... Who would have thought the one thing that sets it in time is the idea of cash?
Is the idea of cash, right? That's the funniest part. Like the one thing that you're thinking is never going to go away because there has been some form of like physical currency in human history since the beginning, whether that meant you had a club and the other person didn't, there's always been a form of physical currency. And right now we have plastic.
Yeah.
And like, my credit card, I'll just call the bank and cancel it.
The fact that that is the only thing that dates this movie is astonishing. Tarantino did such a good job of making sure this movie could be timeless.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I'm even a fan of the fact that that is dating it because you know what? I love that they're robbing a diner because that's not something you really have to worry about nowadays. Yeah. You get the register, but now we had to go wallet to wallet and mine's the one that says bad motherfucker. Okay. Like, of course it does. Yeah. The other two things I want to talk about with this movie and like, obviously I can rip through, but first, John Travolta's dancing is absolutely insane. My goodness, is that ridiculous? And I know that like it might not look impressive because of how smooth he is, but try to do the toe dance that he does and see what happens to your ankles slash toes slash legs and tell me how big the dent is that you leave in your floor from trying to do that. How he pulls that off and how smoothly he does it, knowing he's also on heroin and he's just taking a sip of his $5 shake, whatever. Great. But the main one I want to talk about is the walk-in scene. The Christopher Walken, this watch. He hid this hunk of metal up his ass. So this scene always feels like the scene of like so many people will be like, it's so random. It's out there. You know, yeah, okay, we get it. Like Butch, you know, he's got pride. Okay, great. But he could have done it quicker, whatever. But what I love about it is really this scene, it gets at what the heart of everybody in this movie is. Mm-hmm. They all have pride. They all want to be the man. They're all trying to overcome something to be something better than what they are, right? Like they're all trying to be bigger. And I love that it's a watch, right? Because all that is doing is signifying time. Time. Time keeps passing. Time keeps passing. And yet in this movie, time's all messed up. Everything's in a different order than what it was originally in and all that. But this whole speech is about time and having pride and wanting to leave something behind, a piece of yourself in some way, shape, or form. And that's why you keep doing what you're doing. And when Butch wakes up and decides to kill the guy, couldn't do it. His family wouldn't have done it. His father wouldn't. He couldn't do it. And he also wins a whole boatload of money over it because once the fix was found out to be in. But that's what this movie is the whole time, right? It's everybody worried about being irrelevant or not knowing where they stand, even though it's, you know, that's maybe getting too deep for what Pulp Fiction is, but it's really not. I mean, look at what Jules Winfield's whole speech at the end of this movie is. Look at what Tim Roth and Yolanda are talking about at the beginning of this movie. Look at what Mia Wallace is talking about when she's worried about she's not, you know, she had a pilot, but she doesn't anymore. This scene is so great. And the fact that it's like smack in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
It's just Tarantino's timing is second to none, right?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, there's not much more we can say about this movie really, because it's all been said before, but it's just a masterpiece. That's just what it comes down to. There's a reason why it has secured itself in the cultural zeitgeist as a movie that everyone needs to go see.
Yeah. Sorry, I keep yawning. My back hurts. So when my back hurts, can't take a deep breath, and then I end up yawning a lot. But anyway, it's my upper back. It's up right here. It's so annoying, and I'm hunched, so it's not helping. But no, I agree. It's one of those that's a must watch all the time. And I do think, like, you know, you think about like the movies our parents would tell us were must watches. Some of them are. You know, The Godfather is a must watch, and things like that. But I really feel like this is such a cool movie. Like, how could you not want to? How could, like, I'm gonna watch this with my teenage son one day, and he's gonna be like, "That was freaking awesome!" And I'll be like, "I know. Yep. I told you they can make cool movies in the '90s, and just have no holds barred." It's amazing. It's really an incredible movie, and it transcends, like, you know, time. It really does. Yep. It's just gonna keep going. It's just gonna keep going and going until your guy from The Ghost Story, who ruined everybody's lives, comes around and decides that film no longer matters and it no longer exists. But this is Tarantino's masterpiece. I know you still have a movie higher. I know that means we're going to have to talk about that. But in my opinion, this is – every time I say, oh, that could be better, really all I'm saying is Pulp Fiction's better. That's really what I'm saying every time. So, but we are talking about Reservoir Dogs literally next week, John.
We are. Yeah. We don't have to go talk too much – take too much time talking about how much higher it is. But it's there. Yeah, it's next week.
It's much higher on your list, but it's only one spot higher than Pulp Fiction for me. So Reservoir Dogs from 92, and I finally have Wild Tales, which I put as the wrong year in here. So now I got to edit this. Oh my goodness. So Wild Tales from 2014, which is the Argentinian film, collection of short stories, essentially. So definitely got to make sure you tune in for that one, John. We'll have to figure out when we're actually going to do that, because it's the week before Christmas, and all through the house, I have people starting to come in my house today at 3 o'clock, and they're not going to stop coming until December 28th. So we'll have to figure this out, but we will figure this out. And I'll try to get Wild Tales and Reservoir Dogs both in. They're both pretty short. Especially Wild Tales is a quick one, and it's all short stories, but God, it's so fun. I can't wait to watch that one. I can't wait to talk about that one. Thanks everybody for listening. Hope you enjoyed this. This is probably the most accessible episode we're ever going to do. So if you didn't enjoy this one, too freaking bad. That's it. Bye-bye, everybody. See y'all later.